Alrighty, hello again, everyone, and welcome to it, the Daily Baylor College Podcast for the 20th day of August, 2019. It's a Tuesday. If you're playing the home game, I'm Derek Hunter. I am your host. Welcome to the program. I appreciate you listening, tuning in, clicking on, dropping out, whatever it is you kids do these days when you listen to podcasts. So much to get to. All your letters. It's a special edition of the program. Forget the last, everything that happened, I'll talk about tomorrow, but I promised that I would deliver a reader. We're trying an experiment, going to do a reader email and question and answer section of the program, day of the program. So we'll see how this goes. If the feedback comes in, this sucks, why didn't you talk about whatever, well then maybe we won't do this again. I just want to find some kind of way to interact and involve you guys. And this is what I came up with. So far, it's a podcast. What are we going to do? But that's what we got going. As always, you can email me, Derek, D-E-R-E-K, at dailycaller.com. You can enter to win the signed copy of the Charlie Hurt book. I always got to make sure I say that right. Signed copies of Charlie Hurt's book this week. I think it's going to be this week. Whatever. It doesn't matter. Your entry doesn't expire. And just email me and let me know that that's what you want to be entered into. And so it is written, so it shall be done. I think it was Yul Brynner who said that. I don't know. Anyway, like I said, got a lot of emails, and I appreciate each and every one of them. Some of them I just responded to. Some of them I responded to and said, I'm going to answer that on the show. So you're probably listening. I'm not going to give out full names. I'll just use first names because I didn't ask anybody permission to use their full names. And maybe somebody's listening. They don't want the world to know who they are, although there really aren't any like embarrassing questions. And at the end of the program, the last question will be the most frequently asked question I get. Yeah, the second most frequently asked question is, what's the name of the theme song? And that answer is, it's by an Italian band called Gabin, and the song is called Bang Bang to the Rock and Roll. And I first heard it in Fantastic Four movie, which was terrible, but there was a montage sort of in the middle of it, and I liked the music, so I looked it up, and that's what it was. It's a stupid name for a song, but it's a good song. Italians, what are you going to do? But I'll answer the most frequently asked question because it's about something I just say randomly. Well, it's appropriate when I say it, but something I say occasionally that stems from my youth and my college days. So I shall explain it all. But first, I got to tell you about our friends at Life Change Tea. It's a game changer, ladies and gentlemen. Since I've been drinking Life Change Tea, I feel so much better. I can't tell you how much more energy I have. Pep in the step, I'm up, I'm ready to take on the day. How does it work? What is it? Well, Life Change Tea is a proprietary herbal formula, a gentle daily cleanse designed to rid your body of, well, they call it harmful intruders. I call it yuck. Let's face it, our food was different 60 years ago, minimally processed, free of pesticides, nourishing and healthy for your body. Today, not so much. GMOs, pesticides, herbicides, and heavy processing have depleted the nutrition from our food. It's no wonder you feel run down. You gotta clean out the filth. You gotta get rid of that yuck. Then your body can start absorbing the good stuff that's still left in our food. All you gotta do is try it yourself. Go to getthetea.com. That's getthetea.com. Get ready for more energy. I drink it every day. I got a gallon of it sitting in the refrigerator. Life Change Tea is not available in stores. You go to getthetea.com, and that's how you get it. And you enter the promo code Derek, my name, D-E-R-E-K, at checkout, and boom, you get free shipping. All of that for you. GetTheTea.com. Life Change Tea. Thanks to them for sponsoring the program this month. Thanks to you for checking them out. And thanks to you, mostly, for listening. That makes it all worthwhile. All right. So, viewer. I don't know why everything is viewer. Listener emails. We start with Eugene. For those who didn't provide cities, I don't have their cities. But if there's a city, I'll do it. Eugene, I don't. He says, I enjoy your podcast, not just information, but the humor as well. I have a question about the plethora of Democrat candidates. As usual, I think it's best to follow the money, especially with Democrats. There has to be some reason why these clowns are in the race. Where does all the money go from campaigns? I've never heard anybody actually investigate this angle. Bernie is paying for those houses somehow. Thanks, Eugene. Well, that is kind of a mystery because you hear how much campaigns cost and you think, my God, how are they? What did Beto do with that $25 million that he raised? Or whoever the flavor of the moment was. Mayor Pete raises $12 million out of the blue. Where does it go? Is it in his pocket? Is he living large? Not really. Candidates can, in theory, pay themselves, but that usually happens in House races. People who run for the Senate tend to be wealthier. The people who run for the president tend to be a lot wealthier, and they already have jobs. So they're in Congress, usually, at least governors or congressmen or senators. So they have a job, and it would be unseemly if they paid themselves. Many times they do pay family. But the money goes to campaign staff. When you're running for president, you have to have staff in Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina if you are to be considered a legitimate candidate. Part of the problem with that is you have to pretty much live and breathe Iowa and New Hampshire in particular politics. And there aren't a whole lot of people who live and breathe Iowa and New Hampshire anything, let alone Iowa and New Hampshire politics. So there is a finite number of people available who know all the people to know in the various counties around the state. So they come at a premium. And if you think, well, what about so-and-so? He's supposedly the dean of Iowa politics. Shouldn't that person, you know, they choose the candidate? Not very often. You'd be surprised how much of this stuff is just for hire. It really is. There aren't very many of the gurus in various states who are super duper principled, especially, I mean, with this Democratic field. What difference does it make, in the words of Hillary Clinton, which candidate you support? They all support the same crap. So no matter who you go with, you're getting pretty much the same thing. It's a battle of the packages, or the battle of the wrapping paper, as I call it. So to get the best, to increase your odds of winning the Iowa caucuses, because taking part in the Iowa caucuses is a long process, and it's a pain in the ass. You got to be there a very long time. You've got to be committed. You got neighbors and friends and other random people calling, pulling on you, trying to get you to switch your vote. And you have to stay strong while pulling and calling on other people. To get somebody who can organize that, we'll just call him Bob Johnson. I'm just making the name up. Bob Johnson is the political consultant in the state. Well, Bob Johnson doesn't come cheap. And now with 24 different suitors, Bob Johnson has his choice of dates, of people who he wants to dance with. Well, with no difference between the policies of the people, of the candidates, the difference maker, the decision maker, is money. So you got to pay Bob Johnson thousands and thousands of dollars every month to be your point person, or even just a consultant in Iowa, whatever it is. That adds up pretty quickly. Now, there are Bob Johnsons, there are probably 15 Bob Johnsons or mini Bob Johnsons in Iowa, and then again in New Hampshire. That can add up pretty quickly, as you not only want to hire Bob Johnson, you probably want to take Bob Johnson number two and Bob Johnson number three off the market too. Part of hiring Bob Johnson is to prevent your opponents from hiring Bob Johnson. So that increases the bidding war. It is a... It'd be a seller's market. Bob gets to pretty much write his own check. He brings his own people. That adds to the fee. But you want to sop up all of those people to prevent those people from being hired by somebody else. So there's a lot of the money. But the biggest expenditure, aside from travel, hotels, the signs, the you got to rent the places for the events, you've got to send point people ahead of everything. The biggest expense is being on TV and radio. Mostly TV. You have to be, feel sorry, no matter where you live in the country, be thankful you don't live in Iowa and New Hampshire. And I've been to both states. They're both lovely. It's nothing against the people of Iowa and New Hampshire. But what we get inundated with in the last 6 weeks of a presidential campaign, or maybe in the couple of weeks leading up to whenever our state's primaries are, they live and will live for the next 6 months. It will be inundated, and there will be 24 of them, or probably weed out a little bit. There'll be 20 of them running campaign ads, running radio ads, filling their mailbox with junk. It's coming, if it hasn't started already. This avalanche, nonstop crap. So that's where a lot of the money goes. That's where most of the money goes. Ad buys. They have to secure the time. You have to spend the money you've raised like you're always going to raise that money. You can buy now for ads in December when the caucuses are in Iowa. You just have to put some money down. You know, you lock in the spots. You lock in the time. You can burn through a lot of money running for president of the United States, as you can burn through a lot of money running for anything. So that's where the money goes. As for Bernie, Bernie makes his money from the drone audience out there that buys copies of his books. He's made several million dollars off of books bitching about capitalism. With no sense of irony, he's hammered those big fat checks and parlayed that into three houses. Why? Because who's going to call him out on it? All right, there you go. There's your answer. Next question. Greetings from New Mexico. Blessings to your wife and children. Thank you. My questions are, I think I remember your expertise being healthcare when you worked for Senator Burns. Could you do a show where you educate the high-level points of how healthcare should work, in your opinion? Are there any good ideas from Obamacare that could be salvaged? What is the current administration doing on the subject? What does Medicare for All really mean for us? How do you think healthcare would work most efficiently? If X were done, I would find it very enlightening. Maybe others would too. Regards, Carrie. Well, Carrie, the odds of being able to do an entire show on healthcare are slim. So I will address your question as quickly as I can here. And then I would urge you a lifetime ago, meaning 2003 till the last day of 2005, I was an analyst in health policy at the Heritage Foundation. I wrote papers that don't read, that don't make you want to gouge your eyes out, and I wrote op-eds that simplify a lot of the problems in the healthcare industry, thanks to government. Those are still on the heritage.org website. I would recommend you start there. As far as what could be done, what would be most efficient? This is the one that I like, because this is the one that requires. What would Medicare for All of us really mean for all of us? It would mean much higher taxes, much longer wait times, and slower acceptance of new treatments. The government isn't really quick to adapt to anything. So if some new treatment were developed, which would be unlikely, or at least pretty slow if companies are not able to recoup the costs that they took to research and develop that, you're not going to get a lot of new treatments, especially in the drug business, because if there's no profit motive, there's no reason to research. So you'll only get research into things that a lot of people have, or that's it, really. Something a lot of people have. So if 5,000 people a year come down with something horrible and awful, now you can get some research into that, because if you can find a treatment, something shows promise, you can recoup the costs. This is the, this pill costs $500 a month stuff. Well, if it's $500 a month of death, the choice is pretty obvious, I think. And most insurance companies will cover those things, and most drug companies will offer huge discounts, if not free samples, to people who can't afford their drugs, because dead customers don't really give glowing testimonials about your drug. It's not really good for business. But that's neither here nor there. It's not about drugs, the question. It's about Medicare. It will have to be rationed. That's the only way. You're pretty much going to have to employ every doctor and hospital employee in the federal government, which they're not going to like. We're not going to like. So imagine going to the DMV for a checkup. Imagine going to the DMV for anything. My God, how awful. But he said, how do you think healthcare would work most efficiently if X were done? That's where it gets tricky, Carrie. There is no X. There is no one thing. Everything. Healthcare is so gigantic that everything is tweaking around the edges. If you want to do some things that will have the most impact, sad as it is to say, malpractice reform. Part of the reason why doctors are leaving the industry and many doctors are not getting, people are not getting into medicine, is the cost of being a doctor is ridiculously high. We hear it all the time about the cost of having a child. We know it firsthand in this family, having just gone through it two times in the last 3 years. The reason for that is we are a lawsuit-happy country. As Adam Carolla points out constantly, and rightly so, and brilliant, and I wish I could take credit for this, but I can't, because I'm stealing it from him. In the 70s and 80s, daytime TV was inundated with commercials about ways, jobs that you could get that could lead to a career. You could drive a truck. You could learn shorthand. You could learn court reporting. You could learn all sorts of things. Those were the commercials. You watch daytime TV now, 90% of the commercials are for some law firm saying, we can sue. We, if somebody wronged you, we'll sue them. If anything happened to you, we'll sue them. We'll sue, we'll sue, we'll sue. It's a different type of lesson in society, mostly because those law firms do it on contingency. Hey, if you pay nothing, if we don't collect. Okay, so there's no barrier to entry. There's no reason to not sue. It makes it so easy. And a lot of times, nuisance suits, somebody will throw a few $1,000 at you just to make you go away because it'll cost them more to fight it. Healthcare is no different. Healthcare is exactly the same. If you can limit the amount of money that is paid out in damages, you can lower the cost of medical malpractice insurance. Or if you can, say, make a loser pays situation if the lawsuit is particularly egregious. Look, people are going to sue. Something's going to go wrong. Part of our problem as a people, as a human species, is we're always looking for some kind of external person or force to blame for when things go wrong. Sometimes they're just adverse outcomes. As horrible as it is, as awful as those outcomes are, it just happens sometime. But we're being conditioned through our culture and through society to sue, to blame. Somebody needs to be held responsible for a bad outcome. Well, bad outcomes happen. Those lawsuits add up. It's to the point that some areas in the country, large areas in the country, like most of the state of Mississippi, don't have qualified OBGYNs or whatever they are to deliver babies. They just don't, because people can't afford to practice in rural areas. The medical malpractice insurance is through the roof. So that would be one thing to do, treating. This will be the last bit. I mean, I literally could do a whole show on this, but I don't want to do a whole show on this. I want to do a whole show on the emails, on the questions. Another thing you could do is, and this will be painful. Well, it doesn't have to be done that way. You have to either uncouple health insurance from work or, through the tax code, treat the individual market exactly the same way as people who get their insurance through their employer. If you get a $10,000 a year plan from your employer, you're not taxed on it. And you're paying your percentage, your share, whatever it is, as it's not treated as income. And you're paying your premiums, your share of your premiums, out of pre-tax dollars. So you're not taxed on that money either. If you're buying it in the individual market, you're taxed. You're paying with money you've already been taxed on, your leftover money. So that makes it more expensive. It causes a lot of people to choose not to enter the individual market and just risk it and go without health insurance. I was one of them. I get it. It's, if you're young and healthy and you think, what the hell, I'm not going to need this, then you are willing to take the risk. The problem is the one in 500 people who it doesn't work out for. Costs a lot of money. They end up going bankrupt. So if they could at least get parity on that, treated the exact same way. If you're going to buy in the individual market, you get pre-tax money, and you're not taxed on the money you spend. That would help lower the costs for everybody in that market. Getting rid of a lot of individual mandates would do that as well. But that's, again, for another day, another time. So, Carrie, I see. Thank you for the question, Carrie. This one comes from Kevin. He says some nice things about me at the beginning, but I'm going to skip those because it makes me feel weird when I read nice things about me. He said, you requested that we email questions, so here are two. I still have the RNC affiliation confirmation form. Included is the 7-point survey to let people think someone will read, tally, or care about what you mark. I get those emails too. We need your input on this survey. No, you don't. Why would anyone circle the entire block of strong is beyond me. Telling anyone to what degree you don't care makes no sense. Box number 7, where it says other, should say preserving the Second Amendment. It's interesting to note that the lowest donation checkbox is $35. That's a lot of ground beef and cow farts to give up. Yes, it is, Kevin. The box for other is listed after the 100 level. I suppose it's to shame one for giving less than $35. So the question is, should we donate money to political causes? Perhaps helping clean up filthy neighborhood is a better demonstration of goodwill than paying for the ink and paper in someone's printer. Okay, second. I'll get to second in a second. Should you donate to political causes? Is that better than donating to political candidates? I have a strict policy, mostly because I'm so used to having grown up broke and being broke for the vast majority of my adult life. I have a policy against giving to political candidates. Plus, there aren't very many political candidates I would ever feel compelled to give money to. But I also don't tell anybody what they should do with their own money. It's your money. Do with it what you want. If you want to give to a political candidate, give to a political candidate. You want to give to a political cause, give to a political cause. I would recommend that you don't give to, well, make sure you're able to see where your money's going, that you follow your money if you're giving a lot of money. If you're given, you know, $25 here, $25 there, let it go, feel good about yourself and move on. But if you're going to max out or give thousands of dollars or whatever, the more local it is, the more likely it is to have impact. The more national it is, the more important it is to the entire country. So this is new territory to me. I don't know what it's like to have the kind of money where you can just write a party a $10,000 check or a $100,000 check to attend a dinner because you believe in a cause. I believe in the cause. I think my existence is an in-kind donation. But if I ever get to the point where I could write a $100,000 check and not be harmed by it or choked to death by my wife for writing a $100,000 check to a political campaign, I don't know that I would do it. Just because I think there are more efficient ways. Your local party needs help. Local candidates need help. But again, it's your money. It's a tough question for me to ask because I don't like to ask anybody for money. I don't like to tell anybody what to do with their money. It's like grieving. I never give anybody crap for how they grieve. How you grieve is entirely up to you. And, you know, if you want to get in a cause and go straight in for whatever cause it is that cost you your loved one, that's fine. I fully understand. That's how you grieve. My problem would be when you start to try and infringe on my rights, and that's, I think, fair game. But I never tell anybody how to grieve. I don't like to tell people what to do with their money. You have to believe in it. Believe in it, you know? And if you're looking to clean up a neighborhood, a private charity, I'm all for charitable giving. Politics is a different animal altogether. Those emails that you get are, I've written many op-eds about those emails. We got a deadline tonight at midnight. It's our important mid-month deadline. There is no such thing as a mid-month deadline. If we don't get, I love these ones. We need 14 more donors from your zip code. Like, no, you don't. First of all, you have the wrong zip code in the email you're sending me. And secondly, you're just making this crap up. They just try and give a sense of urgency in the email so that somebody who's not paying very close attention or doesn't understand how politics works just goes, oh man, well, if we don't get, we better get them to that 14 new donors. And let's do that and click into that and donate money. Again, you got money. Do with it what you want, but it's not for me. He asks, the next question is about guns and what sort of how far do I think we should go with gun legislation? This is a tough one. Insane people, crazy people, evil people who have demonstrated a criminal past or a tendency for those sorts of things should definitely not be roaming the streets with a firearm. That being said, we are a nation of people who are innocent until proven guilty, or at least we used to be. Now we have one political party that wants to deem everybody guilty and punish us all for our Second Amendment rights. They don't do it for safety, though. They're using safety as an excuse. So I am loath to support new gun legislation, especially when, as Kevin writes in his email, everybody talks about how, well, this legislation, would it have stopped this attack or that attack if it had been in place? Would it? No, it wouldn't have. But just in case some perfect storm comes together, and then this will prevent the next one. No, it won't. It won't. People determined to do evil will do evil. Look at the Boston Marathon bombings. Those were pressure cookers. People were determined to do evil, and they did evil, and they didn't use guns to do it. So I'm not a big fan of new gun laws. I think that there are, personally, I'd like to see the current laws actually enforced before we start worrying about new gun laws. We're not really enforcing gun laws for all their big talk about we need to get guns off the street. Every time they get a chance to put a criminal away for a gun offense, they seem to, I don't know, look for leniency. They're very forgiving. That nut job up in Philadelphia, that evil prick who tried to kill those police officers, shot 6 cops. He'd been convicted of several gun offenses, and he was out roaming the streets. Why? Because liberals are lax when it comes to enforcement. You solve a problem, you can't campaign on that problem anymore. All right, next we have Alyssa. I think I'm pronouncing that right. I think she's Brian Darling's fan from Scotland. He has a fan. She lives in Scotland. She asks kind of a more personal question. So names, backgrounds, and descriptions of the cats. Well, there's Veruca sitting next to me. They're all, is the word, calico. They look little tiger cats. And then there's Simba, who is the youngest one, but also the biggest with gigantic paws. And Ringo is the oldest one, simultaneously the nicest one and the most violent one. He's all friendly and lets you rub his belly, but when he's in a bad mood, look out. They are all, well, Simba was bought at a pet store. The other two were bought at, picked up at a shelter in Baltimore. The oldest, Ringo, is, I think he's going to turn 10 this year, if not having just turned 10. Then everybody, I think, is a year younger on the way down. Is there anything weird that they do? They're a pain in the ass when it comes to eating food. They'd much rather eat pounce treats. They all walk over me at various points of the night. So that's kind of, I don't know. They're not, one thing that's weird, they don't like people food. The cats I used to have when I moved to Baltimore back in 2001, you had to like be on guard when you had food, especially meat out. They'd want it. They'd lick your plate. They'd finish whatever you got. They'd take it off your plate. One of them, Woodrow, would try and get into meat that was thawing in the sink. These ones, occasionally, they'll eat some chicken or turkey. Maybe a piece of ham if you give it to them. Otherwise, they have no interest. No interest in people food. I'm a damn good cook. They got no interest. I mean, you open a can of tuna, obviously. But otherwise, they're not interested in people food. It's very bizarre. I never had a cat that just turned its nose up at like a your meat sauce for your spaghetti. Just like, nah, no thanks. I'd rather go eat the dry kibble. I'm good. Why did I get them? Because I love cats and I couldn't have dogs. I love dogs too. But dogs, if you live in the city, you got to take them for a walk and carry their poop around in a bag with you. Nah, not interested. Plus, I thought it was cruel. I grew up with a yard, so we had dogs go out in the yard. I'd like a big dog, but if I don't have a yard that's fenced in, I don't want to have a big dog. And you can't go away for the weekend with dogs. You got to have somebody come over every 8 hours or your place is going to be filled with dog feces. So someday, maybe we'll get a dog. You promised forever ago to list many previous jobs at 15 a day. That's material for a whole week right there. Yes, I've had over 70 jobs. I'll give you three jobs. I worked in a factory that made motherboards for something, machinery in manufacturing. I don't actually know. It was a terrible job. I went out to lunch and I didn't go back on the first day. So I never got a full, there were just chemicals everywhere. I think I was supposed to work in the front office, but the whole place smelled like chemicals and I just didn't really, they mailed me a check for like 4 hours worth of work, whatever the hell that was. Never bothered to call to find out, you know, hey, what happened to you? You went out to get a sandwich and you didn't come back. And that was probably for the best. And the weirdest job I ever had was my senior year in college. I was hired, how the hell did I find this job? I think I went to a community center job placement thing. Met a guy in a Denny's, and he drove me around and did this job for one day, and then he handed me the equipment and said, if you want it, it's yours. And I said, yeah, I'll do it. I never met anybody else. That was the only time I ever saw that guy. I never met anybody else associated with the company. The job was to drive around to 16 area hotels and read the events board into a tape recorder. They gave me a little micro cassette recorder with a whole bunch of micro cassettes. And, you know, the Johnson wedding in Salon 7, this company in the breakout session in this room, breakout session in that. It was literally, that was what I was doing. 5 days a week. At 16 area hotels by the airport, in Dearborn, where I lived, and downtown Detroit. And then once a week, I would FedEx that off to a woman in Utah who would allegedly transcribe it. I would contact the boss or owner or whatever the hell he was via email, and they would mail me a check. It was $425 every 2 weeks. And then after like 6 months, I asked for a raise and I got a raise and it was like $500 every 2 weeks. I got to the point that I got to know the staff at the hotel and I was able to say, go in there and get the whole week's worth of event postings. They usually put them up on a piece of paper and I could skip most of the hotels. I got really good at that job because it required literally no skill except for driving. So yeah, that was the weirdest job and the shortest job I ever had. I worked for Merry Maids for 1 hour. I went in 8 o'clock in the morning. I watched my training video, filled out the paperwork, and I filled out the paperwork first. Watch my training video, and they're showing you how to change bed sheets and how to vacuum and all this stuff. And I looked at it, and I'm sitting there, and I'm just getting this sinking pit in my stomach. Like, I can't do this. I can't do this job. I was desperate for a job, but I walked out of the room with the TV and the training video, and there is my crew of three older women. I'll say not old women, but older women. And they look at me like, are you ready to go, Sonny? We're all ready to hop into the Merry Maids van and go off to God knows where and do God knows what. And I just looked at them and I said, I don't think this is for me. And I left. I walked out, never heard from them again. So, yeah, there you go. Oh, man. All right, Jane writes in. I've emailed you a few times in the past. Always appreciate your response. Blah, 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 blah. Promises yesterday. My husband of 45 years. I was a kid when we wed. Ha ha. You're still a kid, Jane. You're able to listen to a podcast. My dad doesn't even have internet, so. Her husband has morphed into someone who has severe Trump derangement syndrome. One of his major talking points is how the government should run health care and set drug prices. I'm totally against this, but for whatever reason, I feel unprepared to firmly argue my position, especially in the wake of his over-the-top emotional reasoning for his views, which is basically most every other country in the world takes care of their people's health care and medication needs, and the USA is behind the times. I know you have particular expertise in this area. Explain why government will run anything, especially the DMV is right. I always love your podcast. Extra fun listening to you fill in on the radio. Thank you, Jane. What can you say to your husband about this? Somebody horribly afflicted with TDS. Well, if government takes over pricing of prescription drugs, Jane, there will never be a treatment for TDS. So there's that. Now, probably don't tell him that. If I'm being perfectly honest with you, Jane, the best way to do this is not have the discussion at all. It's unimportant in the grand scheme of things. You're going to get up in the morning tomorrow no matter what. You're going to have dinner no matter what. You're going to hang out with family and friends no matter what. This just seems like a fight not worth having. I'm not saying cave. I'm not saying pretend to be down with him. Just say, look, I don't want to have this argument anymore. It's not worth it. We just agree to disagree. Let's, you know, pay attention to the things that we both like rather than talking about or arguing with policy. I kind of had to have a similar agreement with my best friend, who is a doctor, who is a big-time lefty. He's not as big as he used to be because now he's a doctor, but when we were in high school, he was a big-time lefty. Now that he's seeing how much he's paying in taxes, he's still a big lefty, but less of a lefty. And we just don't talk politics. Whenever it comes up, he usually brings it up. I say, dude, do you really want to have a fight right now? And he doesn't really want to have a fight right now because we're usually, you know, at a barbecue or hanging out or whatever. And it doesn't need to go there. So I sort of addressed the drug price thing. I will say that the rest of the world gets to live large on our discoveries. All of the major drug companies in the world reside in the United States. They have moved from foreign countries to this country because of our taxes, because of our lower regulations. So if you want to kill that, then set drug prices. Import drug price controls. That's exactly what will happen to the market if you do that. It's that simple. I don't know how else to put it. If there's not already a treatment for something, and a lot of people don't get it, and you come down with something rare that only 10,000 people, 50,000 people a year come down with or are afflicted by, there will likely be no new treatments for that. Because no matter what it costs you to develop that drug and how many false starts you have to go through and how many restarts you have to go through, at the end of it, no matter what that money adds up to, there's the federal government saying, we're only going to pay you $5 a pill. Now, you have a choice. You can accept $5 a pill or you can't sell your pill. And if your pill is really, really good and saves lives, we'll simply steal your idea and we'll make it ourselves. That's what most of the rest of the world does. That's how they end up with lower drug prices. I will say, Jane, that while the rest of the world pays less for prescription drugs, the rest of the world gets prescription drugs between 6 months and 2 years later than we do because of all the arguing and the wrestling with drug companies. Plus, since those countries are paying for the entirety of healthcare and a new drug comes along that's expensive, and even if it's $1,000 a pill and they negotiate it down and arm twist and say, we'll only pay $100 a pill, that's still a lot of money over an entire country. So the government doesn't really have an incentive to add new drugs to their repertoire, really. So it's slower. You might get a better treatment from the United States. I will just say this, Jane. There's a reason the world's rich come to the United States. Mick Jagger, needed heart valve replacement recently. He had that done in New York City. Now, he is probably a dual citizen at this point. I don't know. Actually, I don't know that he ever got a dual citizenship. But I think one of his marriages had to have been to an American. He's a citizen of the United Kingdom. It's free health care. It's the National Health Service. Why wouldn't he go there? He didn't go there. He had it done in New York City. King Hussein of Jordan, the last one, not the current one. He went and got treatment for his, I think it was non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, at the Mayo Clinic here in the good old U.S. of A. Now, he's the King of Jordan. He could get health care anywhere in the world. He could get the best health care that Jordan has. He chose to come here. As is often the case, the world's wealthy come here for their health care. That's not by accident, and it's not because they want to pay a ton of money, which we're lucky enough, if you have insurance, you don't have to pay for. It's because we have the best. We have the best in part because people can go into healthcare and make a ton of money if they're really good at what they do. Ben Carson made a ton of money as a pediatric neurosurgeon. When he was the first person to separate conjoined twins at the head, that's a lot of money. It's a long process. It's an incredible specialty that you not only have to go to medical school for 4 years, you got to do extra work for another 10 years and a resume. I mean, it takes forever to go into these specialties. You're going to kill all of that if you make everybody a government employee. As much as we like to think that everybody goes into the medical profession just like teaching, they just want to teach children. No, they want to have their summers off, too. People go into medicine because they want to help people. Sure, probably a lot of them. But they also want to make a ton of money. Once you take that away, there's going to be fewer people going into medicine. And you're going to have to lower the standards at that point, Jane, because you still need people. And you begin to see how that little problem can snowball. Lower the bar. Get more people into medical school. Oh, well, the bar for graduation is too high. Well, you lower that bar, too. Suddenly, you end up with a whole bunch of people who wouldn't have been able to get into a medical school in the Caribbean going to all the big fancy medical schools. So I would just ask your husband, what's wrong with freedom? That's the one thing we haven't tried. Every time they so-called fix healthcare, they come back in a couple of years saying, well, we need to do something else. We got to do more. We got to do more. That's not working. The old system isn't working. Obamacare is a failure now, when just 3 years ago it was the law of the land, and even talking about changing it was a problem. I would say, why not go in the opposite direction? More government. Big government failing doesn't mean we need bigger government. That's what Democrats offer. How about we try freedom? How about we try the free market? We haven't had a free market in healthcare since at least World War II, when FDR introduced wage and price controls, and employers then started offering fringe benefits as part of employment packages. And then the government said, hey, we like that. We're going to incentivize the continuation of that in the tax code. And right there, it was a shotgun wedding, and ever since, things have been getting progressively worse while getting progressively more expensive. So, first of all, I'd avoid the conversation, Jane. Secondly, I don't want to tell you how to, 45 years of marriage, you know what you're doing better than I do. But, yeah, try a little freedom. That would be my advice. And then just try and avoid the conversation. All right, let's see. This is interesting. Who was this here? This was Adam in Frisco, Texas. So here's my question for your upcoming question and answers episode. What do you think the future holds for Never Trump, the Never Trump movement, in a post-Trump world, whether that's in 2020 or 2024? My opinion, there seems to be two tiers of Never Trumpers. One tier are the ones that I consider to have seen seemed to keep their intellectual honesty, calling balls and strikes, even though they seem to be especially harsh against Trump and Trump supporters. These include Jonah Goldberg, David French, and Guy Benson. The other tier are the ones who have completely thrown their credibility overboard in order to oppose Trump. These obviously include Max Boot, Bill Kristol and Jen Rubin. Neither tier will ever be welcomed into the new woke Democratic Party. Right now, they are being useful tools by the media, but in a post-Trump world, I don't see any of these people ever completely trusted by the Republican Party or the conservative establishment. Curious to see if you agree with me and the way I have laid things out and your thoughts in general on Never Trumpers and their future. Well, Adam, you sent in a bunch of questions, but I was just too wordy. So I chose this one because I find this one very interesting, although they were all good questions. What's going to happen to the Never Trumpers? I don't. The Jen Rubins of the world, the Max Boots and the Bill Kristols, they've chosen career suicide out of spite, really. Not that Max Boot and Jen Rubin ever really mattered. Bill Kristol kind of did. But after the Bush administration, he stopped mattering. He had dreams of mattering again and being a kingmaker. It was never to be. And he kind of lost what was left of his mind. Bill Kristol's a guy who's been dining out on his father's name his entire life. And I suspect he will continue to do that. He manages. I don't know how these people do it. They find a billionaire patron somewhere. They just go, I want to start a business. I want to start a magazine. Will you fund me? And they say, what's your business plan? We plan on losing $1 million a year forever. And they find people are like, well, that's a damn fine business plan. Here's a big chunk of money. Go forth and lose it. That was the business plan for the Weekly Standard. Their business plan was to lose, to try to minimize their losses to $1 million a year. Well, the guy who was cutting that check eventually said, this sucks. I'm not going to keep doing this because the product you're putting out is becoming less and less popular, having less influence. Not that it ever had all that much influence. So I'm going to kind of cut this off. And then Bill Kristol had to find himself another billionaire patron and somehow he managed to do it. I don't know how you do it. I don't know where these people are. But I want to find a billionaire patron to adopt this program, build a studio, and maybe do videos and all that good stuff. If you're a billionaire patron out there, email me and we can talk. So I think Bill Kristol's done. He's been relegated to like third-tier guests on CNN and MSNBC. As far as the rest of Never Trumpers, I don't know. I don't know that they can have a comeback all the way. They should. And I'd be fine if they managed it. But I think the biggest problem I have with these people, and even the Bill Kristols of the world, I have to assume that Max Boot, Bill Kristol, and Jennifer Rubin were lying for all of those years before they went off the deep end and left the Republican Party. I have to assume that they were lying in order to get paid. In order to get money, they pretended to believe in things, non-conservative things. They pretended to care. They pretended to be conservatives. And why am I saying that? Because, and this goes for Goldberg and French too. I don't know how anti-Trump Guy Benson is. I know Guy a little bit. Guy just says what he believes on anything, and he is calling balls and strikes. The pearl clutchers, as I call them, who get very upset that Donald Trump tweeted this or this is that or the other thing. Most of the American people have gotten over that stuff. I get it, that it's unseemly and, oh, it's unpresidential. But that dam is broken. It's too late now. You don't have to keep clutching your pearls over that. But my problem with all of them, especially the Weekly Standard crew, because I didn't expect much. I never really heard of Max Boot, and I didn't expect much from Jennifer Rubin because she was never really conservative. She was just the Washington Post conservative. But the Weekly Standard spent its entirety advancing or saying it was trying to advance and calling for a conservative agenda. And this goes for every Never Trumper out there. Once Donald Trump came in, they were more interested in fighting him, in pointing to him all the problems that they had, and they don't like this and they don't like that, than they were in getting anything done. One thing Donald Trump offered that the conservative movement missed, and by conservative movement in this case, I mean the Never Trumpers. They missed the opportunity. Donald Trump would sign any piece of legislation you put in front of him, I think. Honestly, if a Republican Congress, back when Republicans controlled the House and the Senate, had passed just about anything, Donald Trump would have signed it and then gone on and given a speech about whatever it was, how it was the best, it was the greatest, it was the most amazing thing, and he would sell it on your behalf. The House of Representatives and the Senate did very little. If the Weekly Standard weren't so busy crusading against Donald Trump and thereby ruining their brand, if they had actually just said, I don't know, focus their attention on the House and the Senate, they could have gotten a lot of things passed. They didn't have to celebrate that Donald, they could have hated Donald Trump still at the end, but they had a golden opportunity to get all the things they said they wanted done, or a lot of the things they said they wanted done. If instead of writing 1,500 word so-called think pieces about how Donald Trump is uncouth and oafish and he should never have been president of the United States and why it should have been Jeb out there and not Donald Trump. Instead of focusing on that crap, if they had focused on conservative Democrats and crafting with or encouraging the crafting of legislation that would put pressure on conservative Democrats to support it to overcome a filibuster, they could have gotten a lot more done in the first 2 years of the Trump administration than they did. They had a chance to at least fight, for what they said they believed, and instead they chose to fire down their own trench. They chose to direct their fire not only at Donald Trump, but at anybody who said anything nice about him, that anybody who had a positive word about what he was doing. And they made themselves completely irrelevant while simultaneously ruining their business and harming, missing the opportunity to get the things they always said they wanted done, done. I don't know that that is forgivable, to be perfectly honest with you. I don't know how you look past that. Actually, I don't know how you take that seriously, to be perfectly honest with you. I don't know how you come back and say, well, now we're on the team. Now, yeah, we spent 4 or 8 years just bitching about everybody who did anything. But now we're back in the fight and we're ready to go. Let them back in the fight, okay? Let them back in the fight, but put them way in the back. Don't pay that much attention to them, and sure as hell, don't count on them. If anybody's going to come back in the fold, it has to be slowly. Think of it this way. If you've been paying attention to the conservative movement for the past, I guess it was 10 or 15 years, whatever it's been, every couple of years at CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, there is some new wunderkind up there. He's usually a 15-year-old wrestling with puberty who made some viral videos, wrote a couple op-eds or whatever. And now they're speaking to a standing ovation at CPAC. Well, good on them. But the conservative movement should not embrace them. They always, or not always, but 50% of the time at least, within 5 years, they're now raging liberals because they got a lot of attention when they're 15. And then people stop paying attention and they get bitter and they go, well, why aren't anybody paying attention to me anymore? I know how to get people to pay attention to me. I'm going to go in the opposite direction because the media always loves conservatives who become liberals. They never love liberals who become conservatives. They ignore them. So the pull of attention is too great. So they want the attention, and they get the attention. And then suddenly they let you down. So if and when any of these Never Trumpers try to fully come back into the fold, I would say treat them like a 15-year-old with a speaking slot at CPAC. Maybe don't put them on the main stage, at least not for a couple of years. put them in the meeting room on a panel with four or five other people. Let's see how they do a few times. You don't draft them and put them right in the major leagues. They need to spend some time in double A ball earning their way back up. And if they can't actually do it, if they make you think, I'm not feeling right about this, then we get rid of them again. Okay? So, there. That would be my answer. He also did ask this one. I can answer it really quickly. He said, I'm a big fan of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I am. What do you think is the next phase for Marvel? Seems like the social justice warriors have infected all our best franchises. And he lists them. Yeah. They're going to have, like, in the next phase of Marvel movies, it's going to be, there's going to be the first LGBTQ superhero. And I just recognize that I'm yawning. The next rounds of movies are all, like, second and third tier characters. I'll probably watch them when they come on cable or can rent them on iTunes. But in general, not super interested in the next round because they're mostly characters I didn't grow up on. They kind of just finished with the ones I grew up on, except for Spider-Man. I says, I've been asking, this is from, who is this? This is Johnny. Says, I heard way back in April and May that the IG report was coming soon. I remember that. Remember the Inspector General's report about the origins of the Mueller investigation? It was supposed to be a long time ago. In June, it was coming soon. And again in July, Trump declassified a bunch of info, apparently. Still waiting on that. Actually, the president didn't declassify information. This is one of those things. I don't know what the hell is going on. The president could declassify everything. Instead, he gave the authority to the attorney general to declassify anything he wanted, which, again, didn't really do anything. The president could say, I did stuff without actually doing anything. If there's something, and if there's a smoking gun in there, I would think that the president would release it by now. I don't know. He says, so what do you think is going on and what might be taking so long? Is the administration possibly waiting to release the damaging info during the 2020 campaign season? If they are, Johnny, that would be incredibly stupid. It's they're being hurt now. If there is what it seemed like for a while there was in this information, there was the smoking gun, if there was proof of collusion amongst Democrats with the intelligence community to target American citizens, and they're sitting on it, they're letting the narrative set. They're letting the concrete harden. You've got to get it out there quickly. It will hurt whenever it comes out, and it will hurt in perpetuity if laws were broken and people are charged. I don't know why they're doing what they're doing, except for maybe they don't know what they have yet. Maybe they're actually doing a real investigation, although the Inspector General's report should have been out by now. I would have preferred that the president just declassified everything and let us make up our minds. But if Barr is looking to bring criminal charges, I hope they don't bring politics into it. I hope if they find criminal activity, they just charge it and go with it whenever they find it, whenever they get it to the point where they think they can prove it in a court of law. I hope it's not played politics with, but you're right. This stuff should have been out by now. I don't know what the deal is. Let's see. Julie Hunt Juno. She says, what's your opinion on the feasibility of the Convention of the States for setting term limits and budget? I have supported them. My home state of Louisiana is on board. Just wondering about realities. There are far too many Democratic states that will never go along with it. This is the idea of amending the Constitution through a convention of the states, rather than having a constitutional convention where God knows they'd rewrite the whole thing and conservatives would cave to liberals. I love the idea in theory, Julie. In practice, I honestly don't know if we can trust these people. I really don't. I know I wouldn't trust them at a constitutional convention where they could rewrite the Constitution, where they could propose amendments is something different, but I'm not sure we could ever get consensus. We may have seen the last constitutional amendment in our lifetimes until the left fully destroys the country and they rewrite the whole damn thing. I don't know what we could get that kind of consensus on. I think a better idea is to fight in the courts and do things on a state level. That would be my suggestion. This next question comes from Shark. I love Shark. Shark used to listen to me in Baltimore. He's got a heavy, heavy Boston accent. Loves himself some Tom Brady, like for serious, loves himself some Tom Brady. Says, having spent some quality time on the Hill, who is someone you met, whether you agreed with their politics or not, who is actually a good person but comes off as a douche slash wacko in public? People from Boston. Conversely, I'm sure there are more of these. Who is perceived as a great person that is a raging a-hole? Have a buddy who's worked on the Hill for Republicans and always said James Carville was a great guy. Treated everyone, both sides, the same. Conversely, he always said McCain was the biggest D-bag he ever met. A lot of that has come to light to this point. So what do you say, Shark? Well, Shark, upon Capitol Hill, it's different. I was always told that Jim Bunning, who was a senator from Kentucky, since passed away, that he was a jerk, that you wanted to avoid him. He was just crotchety and old, and I couldn't understand. The guy was a Hall of Fame Major League Baseball player, pitched no-hitters in both leagues, and he was supposedly crotchety after 18 years in the Senate. I didn't find him that way. I was afraid of him because I'd always heard stories. Brian Darling was one of them. He said, don't ever bring up a baseball to Jim Bunning and ask him to sign it unless it's stamped Made in China, because he won't sign Made in China baseballs. Well, he signed one for Conrad Burns. I think Conrad had him sign it just because it was made in China. But I never saw him be a jerk to anybody. And when I had chances to hang out with him, which I did, on a number of occasions, because he and Conrad were good friends, he always laughed at my jokes. He told dirty jokes. It's just like, you know, what you'd expect from a guy who had a career in pro sports. So he wasn't the monster, and I never saw any of it. Now, maybe he was to other people, and because I worked for his friend, that he was nice to me. But I was always surprised by Jim Bunning being much nicer than I thought that he would be, and then I was told that he would be. Nobody was really a jerk to me when I worked up on the Hill. Most people were nice. I'd smoke cigarettes with Barack Obama. I never saw Hillary except for passing in the hallway. She was tough to be near because she always was surrounded by staff and security. But in general, most people were not. If you were a staffer and you're not bothering them, they'd be nice. And as far as John McCain, I've heard the horror stories. I had friends who worked for John McCain. My interactions with John McCain was he signed a bunch of books for me, and he let me ride the members-only elevator when he didn't have to. So I thought he was nice enough. So in the political world, in the media, it'd be a better place to frame this. In the media, the nicest person who you think is secretly a monster and might be tough to be around is Ann Coulter. Ann is super sweet and super nice and not at all the combative person that she's portrayed by the liberal media as being. On the other side, I can't really say who that person is. But if you do just some Googling the media personality in prime time with the worst reputation and the worst stories, I can say that they're true. That's all I can. Whoever you find, and if you look, because I might want to do their show one day with my next book or something, and I don't want to name them. But if you find out who's got the stories behind the scenes of the worst person with the highest turnover and just an awful person off the air, and I think you can figure that out if you do just a little bit of Googling, Shark. I will say that the stories are true and there are much worse stories out there too. Finally today, this is from Graham, and this is the most frequently asked question of any that I get. Because every once in a while I say this, and then the emails come in. It says, Derek, who is Frank Tanana, and what makes him holy? It's the holy Frank Tanana. Now, Frank Tanana, this comes from my friend Jeff from back in college. I don't know why he said it. He said it, and it stuck with me. I thought it was hilarious. Frank Tanana was a pitcher in the major leagues. He's a very good pitcher. He used to be a fireball pitcher, apparently, in the late 70s. Then he blew his arm out. Then he became a junk ball pitcher. But he was a very effective junk ball pitcher. He almost had as many victories, career victories, as Jack Morris, who's in the Hall of Fame, and he actually had more strikeouts than Jack Morris did by a couple of hundred. He's the 23rd, of all the pitchers who didn't make the Hall of Fame, the top 25. He's in the top 25 of strikeouts or something like that. Hell of a pitcher. Apparently a hell of a nice guy and a very religious guy. I don't know why Jeff came up with Holy Frank Tanana, but he said it occasionally, and it would stick. It stuck with me. It's instead of saying holy crap or holy whatever, holy Frank Tanana. And that's where it comes from. It's really that simple. I was doing a lot of drinking and perhaps a lot of smoking of marijuana, which certainly added to the comic effect of what Jeff was saying. But that's where it comes from. Just my buddy. I actually tried to call him, and I was going to try and record him on speakerphone so he could, because I don't know where he actually came up with it. Maybe he heard it from somebody else. But I got his voicemail. So that mystery shall forever, at least until the next time I talk to my buddy Jeff, remain. But that's what it is. Frank Tanana was a pitcher. He pitched for the Detroit Tigers from the 89 season to the early 90s or something like that. I just remember him from there. I've had some of his baseball cards. And then when Jeff said in the mid to late 90s, holy Frank Tanana, I thought, oh my God, that's funny. I don't know why. Sick sense of humor. Maybe it was the drugs. But there you go. That is where Holy Frank Tanana comes from. Feel free to substitute your own minor local sports legend and make it your own. That is all the time we have for today. Thanks to everybody who emailed. Sorry I couldn't get to everybody. It's just that time flies and my mouth does too. And I can't control either, sadly. We'll be back with another exciting episode and regular program tomorrow. Don't forget you can email me, Derek@DailyCaller.com. If you want to be entered in the contest to win Charlie Hertz's book, send in your name. See you tomorrow.